altogether consistent with what he says somewhere else. And Kassira would say, well, yes, you mustn't think take these sentences they're presided to, which we didn't like much, being trained.
Yeah.
Then other people would say, but is it true what he says? Then he would look shocked. Then he would ask whether what Racine said was true.
Yeah.
It was a question to ask.
Yeah.
What you want to know is what he meant. And not only what he meant, what he taught. And to what extent was it, did it have an influence on Kant? That's what you want to know. True. He would say that is indeed a very difficult question.
He was asking historians questions.
Entirely. And then someone would press. He would say, that is such a difficult question, I think it might have puzzled Leibniz himself. That meant it was very top marks. The question, what he thought about was Rousseau, Kant was of course the center. All rivers flowed towards him. In the end, it became very boring. He was very unhappy at Oxford. And he left us very soon thinking none was really good, what he called philosophy.
Yeah.
Ignorant, talkative. Crossman was the only one who was any good.
Really?
He was a kind of German, someone talked like German.
Yeah.
And finally went to Sweden, to Göteborg, a great success. Then he went to Yale, who is absolutely worshipped.
Yeah.
Well, he's a good historian of philosophy, but nothing else.
Mm.
There's no sharpness. No, no, I mean, you couldn't persuade anyone of anything philosophically, I don't think. It's bland, it's learned, it's lucid, it's beautifully done.
Yes.
Some are unmemorable. Anyway, as a result of this, we all met together in my room. We thought, why didn't you go on meeting under more interesting, talk about real questions? That's how it got going.
Yeah.
As a result of this seminar. Now that must have happened in maybe 34. So in 35, I think, we must have begun to meet. Once it came. And MacKinnon used to come occasionally. But he talked terrible nonsense always. So just a very worthy of fraud.
What emerges from what you're saying, though, is I find hard to understand. That is, there's a certain sense in which the glamour of philosophical precision is leading you to say that the history of philosophy, the history of ideas, is a kind of bland second best.
No, no. The history of philosophy is taught by the Germans.
It's taught by the Germans.
Yes, that's all. The history of philosophy is a perfectly good subject. If you've really done philosophy yourself, and you know what keeps people awake at night.
Yes.
If you've agonized,
yes,
then you know what they're talking about. If you would try and enter the clothes of Descartes, Spinoza, want, ask yourself how they looked, again, this business, what things, then if you can see how such a question might have been troublesome or might have preoccupied them, then I think it's all right. If you just copy out,
yes,
say they said this and they said that, they didn't say this, since they objected, so they answered. It's very boring.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So you see.
I'm trying to trace your own turn.
Well, I'll tell you.
Towards historical questions.
In these discussions, which are entirely unhistorical, I took as much part as anybody else. I made it, because it was about, I wasn't going to talk about myself, I was still in there with the two bitter antagonists locked in a perpetual struggle, and that gave it a certain nip.
Yeah.
You see? And,
but you said earlier you defended one proposition.
Well, just in order to show you that I took part in discussion. I went to a paper given by Russell in Cambridge when he went back to philosophy. It was quite late. In the 30s. He went to Austin, traveled. We knew he was going to read a paper. It rather excited us. And he, it was called The Limits of Empiricism. It was a new line. He produced an example, which I can't remember, which was really his own mind, but I then went on, you see, logical positivism was then beginning to be dominant. That meant the propositions were either empirical or logical tautologies, either were deductive or to verify the experience. Now, the proposition that I used to bring it up that yellow is more like red than it is like blue is not a proposition that follows from any definition, because you can learn what these things are by pointing. You can't define colors anyway. But quite a problem whether you could or not. There was no logical premise for which this followed deductively.
But it is a true statement.
It's not only true, but irrefutable. And you don't verify the experience, because once is enough. You don't say, one day, maybe we can't tell. Maybe blue will turn out to be more like yellow than it is. Wouldn't mean anything. Time mean by yellow, time mean by red, and mean by blue has a fixed relationship in the sort of chart of colors. This seems to me a priori. Not a priori, but anyway, and not so much a priori as incorrigible.
Yeah.
And that was denied by everybody who wanted to say all propositions were either calculable and rather logical in structure,
that
were deductive, or had to be verified by experience. That I used to go on and on pressing and reading, and that did become something. It entered the literature in the end. And it's quite contrary to what it's called. It's got a name. Incorrigible proposition of a certain type and so on. More or less categorical statements. It's called conceptual truth. Not empirical nor logical. All right. So that contribution I constantly. Another thing which I won't bother with a particular.
No, I'm asking the question. I want to know.
It has nothing to do with these two ideas. Another proposition was that it is not true that all particular propositions, all singular propositions, could be either verified directly or could follow from general propositions, could be made probable, which is a non-rational position. If you say something is something, either you see it, you verify it in those days, or you say it's a general proposition to affect all bodies, all water, all bodies gravitate, this is the body. How do you know that all bodies gravitate? Follows from something else, maybe. In the end, it rests on observation, probability, coherence, anything you like, something, and all these empirical tests. I would say no, there are propositions which are not true, they're completely irrational, and I needn't believe them. They have no evidence for them, they couldn't have. But they have meaning. The great thing, problem was meaning, not truth.
Yes.
You see, very meaningful. I said, if this horse had been called Charlemagne, it would have won. You see, but why would it have won? I give no reason.
Yes.
It just would have won. Now, it's counterfactual.
Yes.
Counterfactual propositions on the whole are deducible from general propositions. If this horse had done it, it would have been defeated because it's too weaker than the other horses. Some reason you're given. I give no reason.
Yeah.
It's perfectly irrational, and I'm convinced it would have won. I bet on this horse because it's called
Charlemagne.
And I'm quite, you see, then it doesn't run. I said, it certainly would have won. How do you know? I don't know, but I said it.
Yeah.
How do you verify that proposition? Well, we say that there are no general propositions, or general propositions which it follows are too weak. They may be too weak, that's not the point. I think it means something by itself to hell with general propositions.
Yes.
I'm not talking about that. You see? In other words, there's something funny about hypothetical in unfulfilled conditionals.
Yes.
That's counterfactual. Then it also got into the literature in a big way. Yes. After that, after I abandoned philosophy, it had a career.
You regard it as a kind of a child of yours who made.
I regard myself as a secret pioneer, nobody knows it.
Yeah.
I didn't write it down.
Yeah.
As a secret pioneer of this, I didn't want very long about it, but it became something anyhow.
Yes.
It's now madly to put possible worlds and possible things in them, and all kinds of things of that sort.
Yeah.
But I got it going among these people.
Yeah.
It never got outside the walls of all souls.
Yes.
But some of them then gave it
to. And you never got it down on paper in
never.
An extended way.
Never, never.
Do you regret that?
No, I don't think particularly. I've no sense of copyright. Then what else? I used to complain about phenomenalism, which I was against. That's the proposition that nothing exists except sense data. But if you say something like there were dinosaurs in the world, it means if you had been there and were like you are now, you would have seen a dinosaur. I didn't believe it meant that. I thought it meant there were dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Whether you were there or not, but even if you hadn't been there, but even if you had been there and hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
And so on. And that I used to defend. Mainly anti-positivism, that was the great thing was the case ready here.
Yeah.
That's what, and he was the only positivist of 100% kind we had.
Yeah.
He got from Vienna, he got from Schlick,
yeah.
He thought he got from Wittgenstein, he got from Schlick and other people in Vienna in 1932 or the autumn, when he went there.
Yeah. And he never let go.
He spread the doctrine.
Yeah.
Yes, he did let go in the end, but not for all.
Yeah.
I thought there was something wrong with it.
Yeah.
And there is indeed a footnote about me, my objection in language, truth and logic, which is the Greek manifesto.
Yeah.
I don't think I had much more footnotes. I was never a first-class philosopher. Never. I was quite a good tutor. And enjoyed teaching. I never taught for less than an hour and a half, even though I was all intelligent.
Do you regret that you weren't a better philosopher?
Yes. I was sorry not to be better than I was. I envied. Yes, I was not very stronger, because I had lots of other interests.
Yeah.
I was quite happy. I mean, I had a full life.
Yeah.
You see? But I was, would have been glad to have been much cleverer than I was. I knew that was the first rate. I knew I was good enough to go outside and take, but I was quite respected. I wasn't despised.
Yeah.
But I was one of the brethren.
Yeah. Among the brethren, who of your time do you think was the best philosophical mind?
Without a doubt, Austin. Cleverest man I ever knew.
Yeah.
Apart from Keynes, I didn't know at all well. Very clever man. Someone negative. Some ways grammatical. Very, very clever man. Rigorous kind. And great friend.
Yeah.
All my life, I mean, really were bound by ties of friendship. I was never
frightened. I find that odd, because your picture of him is antipathetic in certain ways. You obviously deeply admired him philosophically. But I don't... I have a much stronger sense of a radically different temperament.
Well, yes, that's true.
And a habit of mind.
Yes, it's all the same.
What drew you together?
Peace and... He came to ourselves, you see.
Mm-hmm.
After a year, and I used to talk to him about philosophy every morning. From breakfast to lunch, right in the pupils.
Yeah.
And that taught me more than I ever learned from anybody.
Yeah.
That itself is enough.
Yeah.
He was entirely honest. He was very vain. He was honest, rigorous, and extremely kind, really, by nature. I thought he was admirable. He really was dedicated to his subject.
Yeah.
And very skeptical about himself.
Yes. What do you think he liked about you?
God knows. God knows. Just felt me to be sympathetic. So he thought I was honest and adequately intelligent. Sufficiently intelligent to be an interlocutor. I think he had a certain respect for honesty. That's when I was.
Yeah.
And he used to ask him questions, which he quite enjoyed. You could talk freely to me, that's the thing. He was a difficult man, with very few friends, very locked up. For some reason, it worked chemically. And he found me very familiar, could talk to me easily about his plans, about himself. There was no difficulty.
Yeah.
He wasn't exactly familiar with people. With me, he was very much tremendous at ease.
Yes.
He talked about music, he talked about politics. He went to Russia, some like that, because people were so rigorous and austere and rather fanatical. It was quite like that, but didn't very long. He was very terrifying and modern. His fellow kept him in order.
Yes.
He was a tremendous disciplinarian. I was never least afraid of him, never put down by him. And he judged to me easily.
You didn't feel a sense of intellectual inferiority in relation to
him? Yes, I didn't mind it.
You didn't bother.
quite a lot of cleverer than me. If he said something, I paid respect to it, more than I would to my own view. I defended my views, he used to get the better of me, then I would accept his views. Quite a lot. He always understood what one meant. He never made one translate into his own particular lingo. If any philosopher I knew did not have a formula. With Freddy, I had to be positivist formula. With Ryle, similarly. I mean, you had to translate your proposition, the kind of language they liked. They said, you mean so-and-so, and then said in their words. Well, you would try to adapt yourself to what they were saying. With Austin, he understood you immediately and talked human language, such as you understood totally. Ordinary English, from the beginning. There wasn't a particular vocabulary which was tied to a particular doctrine.
And he had an extraordinary sense of the nuance of ordinary language, and extraordinary confidence in its subtleties.
Certainly, certainly. But above all, he talked your language perfectly easily.
Yes.
And you said something, he answered exactly your language without any difficulty, because he had no addiction to particular.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the biographical thread. You go through...
Well, no, I was going to tell you about his two ideas. That is purely accident. Two things happened. One was a Russian called Rachmilevich, who I never talked to about.
No.
Right. Who was a dominant influence on me.
Say that again, Rachmilevich.
Not easy. I use the name I make acknowledge in my book on Karl Marx.
Right.
You'll find it spelled that.
Ah.
R-A-C-H-M-I-L-E, then anything like V-I-C-H, W-I-T-S. You know what
I'm saying? Yes, I
see. Rachmilevich. Rachmiel is a Hebrew name.
Yes.
It's a Jewish name. He was called, what was his first name? Lemchen is what his parents called him in German, but his real name was Solomon.
And where did you meet him?
In London. He was a Russian Jew, 15 years or so older than me. His career was simple. He was given Riga, my town. He knew my family. He'd been to four or five German universities before the First World War. He studied Kant and philosophy in general. He could read musical scores. He was deeply interested in music. He knew a great deal about composers, conductors, and players. He was one of the most, in that sense, interesting people I knew. He came to London because he was a refugee. It's typical of him that when they left Russia, they went via Constantinople. He sat in the garden of Constantinople waiting for an English visa, reading Eddington. Then, in 1919, or 18, whatever it was, reading Eddington in English, which he learned, and suddenly found that there was kind of, Susara was going around him, suddenly stopped, he realized he was sitting in a synagogue, they were all saying psalms, and it came to, he thought he had a prayer book, and it came to his turn. He was reading his last book at that time, had to do with Einstein, I think.
Yes, sir.
He knew mathematics, he knew some physics. He came to London, he was a social democrat, Menshevik, and he used to talk to workers in Riga, wore a beard, bearded Menshevik, talking to workers on crossed logs on the outskirts of Riga about the 7th Menshevik Congress.
Yes.
We'll see. Now, when he came to London, he lodged with a cousin of his who was a timber merchant, who was my father knew, who was a very sort of a tremendous businessman. Made in Lord's fortunes, called Shalit, a well-known Riga timber name, for whom he worked by studying the English law, giving legal advice, just to get things up. It wasn't really very helpful, but he was his wife's cousin, and so they gave him lodging, and he worked in his office. He wasn't very interested. He was tremendously ingenious, and tremendously sophisticated, and brought all these gifts to bear on the business, not very useful. Every Saturday afternoon, he went to the British Museum, where he read till 7.
Uh-huh.
What he read, I can't tell you. But every Saturday afternoon, 1 o'clock till 7, he read for 6 hours steadily. Now, he went to every concert that was in London. He sat in the gallery, leant forward to look at the conductor. You could see this figure leaning forward prominently. Well, I met him, God knows, in the house of these timber merchants my parents knew, and he began talking to me about something. I was 50, 60, not a schoolboy. And he began talking about Russian literature. Well, I just saw an unusual man before me. So I began talking to him. He then began telling me about Kant and about philosophers, and I only half understood, but I was fascinated. And I went on knowing him till his dying day. He talked about physics, he talked about mathematics, he talked about everything. Well, he was a pure amateur. He never taught anywhere or anything. During the war, he made friends with a man, independent labor member called Horobin, whose speeches he wrote. Just like that.
Yeah.
He did everything. I mean, point was, he was the most generalized intellectual I ever met.
Yeah.
When he came to Oxford and looked at Maurice Barra's translations, he pointed out certain errors, I get to say. And Barra said, I didn't wish to meet him. He's a one-man demolition squad. But David Cecil, for example, thought he was delightful. And Stuart Hampshire thought he was delightful. So he got on with Oxford intellectuals easily. He was not very beautiful. He had a bad end. I think, a brain fever. He went off his head. In the end, he did get mad. Began writing love letters, 7 or 8 letters at the same time.
When did he die?
I think in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Late 50s, I would say.
Yeah.
But I used to ask him to come see me in Oxford.
But he was an influence in your turn towards in this sense,
first
Russian
of all,
literature?
First, in every respect. First of all, he turned me towards philosophy. By explaining what they were about. I only half understood, but I began to have some inkling. Secondly, he talked to me about Russian literature. Thirdly, he talked about Marx, because he was a Marxist of sorts, and explained that Lenin betrayed the revolution. I thought, what's wrong with him? Quite simple. Plekhanov made me read, you see. Fourthly, he made me talk about music, talk about conductors. Talk about difference of styles of conductors. Talk about composers. Talk about what Bach would have said if he lived now. What he would have said about jazz. He would have said, das ist eine Teufelsmusik. But he would have been interested. But he would have been interested.
Yeah.
You see? He went to Sicily for his holidays and lectured the Sicilians on philosophy in Italian. He was an extraordinary man. He came to nothing. He didn't write a line. And he died poor. Neglected, his relations kept him going. I used to see him. But in the end, as I say, he began to suffer mentally, and that was until the end. But he was very amusing. The point about him was he was very witty and terribly funny. And when you said things to him, he would say, wait a moment, wait a moment, I will answer. Wait a moment, not so fast, wait a moment. Now, Kant says, then we talk in Russian, of course.
Yeah.
You, thou, ты,
ты
говоришь, а я говорю, ты, you see, ты думаешь, you think these categories.
Yeah.
Then he explained to me what Husserl was about, what Husserl's disciples were about. He was a tremendous polymath. But he had a sharp brain and a wonderful imagination. And I owe him a very great deal. That's why I thank him and the Theon Marx.
Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't notice that. I missed that.
No, nobody knows that unless I tell them. But he was a genuine influence. And partly kept my Russian going from the age of 16, 17. I didn't talk much Russian until then.
Yeah.
But with him I did talk. A strong Yiddish accent, which I must have got from his parents.
Yeah.
But he was a clever boy. I mean, he went to these German universities, gave very good descriptions of Heidelberg, Freiburg, 1 year in each, as people did. What term in each you wanted about. Told me about lectures, what Hermann Cohen was like, what, you know, Windelband, all these unknown names.
Yeah.
He knew all about Kuno Fischer, and what Trotsky made of Kuno Fischer. He's an extraordinary figure, I tell you.
Yeah.
Not many people knew him.
Yes,
I was the only person who could talk like that in the world.
And I would have thought also a kind of opening outwards from the inwardness of Oxford in a certain sense.
Oh, absolutely.
Offset.
Certainly. But he was the first person who gave me a taste for ideas in general. Interesting ideas, tell, as such. And then with the...
Already in St. Paul's?
Towards the end of St. Paul's, the last 2 years. I didn't see very much. I saw him, what, in those days, 5-6 times a year. But when I was in Oxford, more frequent. I used to look him up. We used to have lunch and so on. And then in the afternoons, I'd find the British Museum. Then, the Warden of New College, Fisher, in 1933, asked me to write a book on Karl Marx for the Hume University Library. Mm-hmm. So his first offer to Lasky, who refused. It was then offered to Frank Packenham, Lord Longford, who refused. It was then offered to... Cole, who refused. It was then offered 4 or 5 other people, I expect. In the end, despair, they offered it to me, and I thought, well, I was in my first year teaching philosophy quite early. Mm-hmm. This would have been end of 33. It had begun the end of 32. I thought, well, I'd read a little bit of Marx, because I had to read PPE, where Capital is the text. I could never get through it. I read a certain amount of it. Obviously, Marx is going to be more important, not less. If I didn't write about it, I'll never read it. And I'll never know what they're talking about. Just I haven't read Freud, and I shall never know. Because it's too lengthy, too boring, no good. I was thrilled with reader. So I said, rather, yes, all right. Then I began reading Forerunners, and I began reading the French encyclopedias, beginning in the 1750s. That gave me a great taste. I thought they were wonderful. Mm-hmm. And Plekhanov wrote about them in a very appetizing way. Mm-hmm. Plekhanov is a mordant, extremely clear, and rather sharp writer.
Yeah.
Because, you know, of all the Marxists, Fathom is readable.
Yeah.
I read Engels a bit too, but mainly that. So I read about Helvetius and Holbach and Diderot and Rousseau and everybody. Went. I read Rousseau before, automatically, in Oxford. And then I read various Germans, such as, I can't know who, Rodbertus, or whoever the name, von Stein, is that the word, proletariat, you can imagine, LaSalle. And that gave me a general taste. And finally, of course, London, I went to London Library. And by pure accident, stumbled on Herzen. Mm. Because there's a very good Russian collection.
Mm. Yes.
You see, done by this man, Hagberg Wright, who is a Scandinavian Slavonic scholar. Now it isn't, I mean, since 1940 it's not good. But so long as he collected. It's better than the museum, British Museum, in some ways. And I knew vaguely Herzen. I knew there was a bearded sage, 19th century. Heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And then I saw his name, so out of pure curiosity, I took out one volume.
He was enchanted.
And never looked back. Yeah. He was a central figure in my life. Well, that, if you take all this in combination.
And this is happening 1933, 34, 35. 33 to the war.
Yeah. Then I began lecturing on these French encyclopedists. Well, nobody took the slightest interest in it, you know, but I got an audience. God knows where they came from. They tell them all about Holbach, all about arguments in the French Revolution or Condorcet. You see? Yeah. And that was a series of lectures which is intellectually not very taxing. But to me of interest.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's how I got into that world.
Yeah.
Simply in order to write a book on Marx.
Yeah.
Which I wrote and wrote and wrote. The original book on Marx was twice the length of what appeared, and then I was forced to shorten it. That was agony of the most ghastly kind. Mm-hmm. I couldn't leave out chapters because it was chronological. Mm-hmm. Drops of blood. It's fearful. I didn't keep. But I threw away.
Oh.
No. So.
It's a shame.
Look, I think you have to go.
Yes.
And I was dressed.